Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
What is up, everyone? My name is Jacob Minnig, host of the Behavior Health Integration Podcast. Today we have a very special BHI episode. It is ketamine-assisted therapy versus psychedelic-assisted therapy. What is the difference? In this episode, I have returning special guest Dr. Christopher Fisher and Dr. Sophia Piva. They are the owners of Propel Therapeutics in Sacramento, California. Next, I have first-time special guest Jordan Dabrowski. Jordan is a social worker in psychedelic medicine from Chicago, Illinois. She runs her own private practice, Willow and Leaf Counseling. In this special episode, we will go over many factors of both psychedelic-assisted therapy and ketamine-assisted therapy. We will go over the aspects of how long a drug lasts, where are the policy procedures of taking these drugs when it comes to assisted therapy, and as well as how long is the drug response time in each. And another interesting factor in this episode, there will be a question and answer segment. Again, I am truly excited to get this episode started. So without further ado, let's begin. Jordan, it's really awesome having you on the show.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I love being able to talk about these things.
Yeah, just so like just right off the bat, again, I know you're from Chicago right now, but what originally got you involved in this field of mental health, as well as the realm of ketamine and psychedelics?
Yeah, so I have gone through a lot of different professional hats in my history. And I think the journey with psychedelics really traced back to a trip to Peru I went on my senior year of high school. Nice. I'm a lifelong asthmatic, and as someone who was hiking the Inca Trail, it was a really inconvenient time for my inhaler to break. And so thankfully the guide I was with went to some of the local indigenous women and came back with this plant. I believe it was called Munya, but what I remember mostly is that you rubbed it between your hands and it worked way better than the inhaler. Okay. And that got me thinking, wow, there is so much out there that we don't have in the US, things that aren't getting like published or you know, presented. I'd much rather grow a plant than take an inhaler that makes me jittery all day.
Right.
And so I ended up going into college thinking I was going to be an ethnopharmacologist until I realized that's an incredibly difficult field to get into. And so I kind of dabbled around a little bit. I ended up getting really sucked into, I stuck with the ethnography piece and then got an anthropology degree. I also went into the religion side of thing and thought that I wanted to work with spirituality. Flash forward to going to grad school, and I was going to go to Masters of Divinity and Masters of Social Work.
Oh, wow.
But social work pulled me in because I liked working with people too much directly. And so I started doing therapy right out of grad school, and I loved that work. I loved working with intercultural communities and working through the complex issues. And then the pandemic hit. And just burned me out. You know, I'm definitely part of that mass exodus and wanted something. I was tired of seeing these like systems not work for people. And so I wanted to get into a field that got me really interested, that I saw was emerging, that I had a lot of faith in. I put an application out there to a company some people might have heard of, Field Trip Health, and got a job. So I kind of got to come full circle to the psychedelics. I started with plant medicine, ended up working 2 years in ketamine-assisted therapy. And now I provide both ketamine-assisted therapy and integration and preparation for other substances as well from a harm reduction standpoint. And it feels like a great integration of kind of all the little hats I've gotten to wear over the years.
All right. So where are you at right now then?
So right now I'm in Chicago. I recently, so the Chicago Field Trip Clinic did shut down. But I found another clinic that I can work at providing psychedelic therapy through ketamine to my patients. And then I have a small private practice out in the Logan Square neighborhood offering, like I said, psychedelic integration, harm reduction, helping people with other types of non-ordinary states of consciousness, and then doing EMDR therapy as well.
That is so cool. Like, I'm actually kind of curious about the whole EMDR
aspect. Oh, yeah.
Like, when, so you apply that with the ketamine therapy?
Sometimes. I depends on the person's need, honestly. So I really think the EMDR is another state of consciousness. For those of you who aren't familiar, EMDR is the use of bilateral stimulation, which is a fancy way of saying stimulating the left and the right sides of your brain at the same time. And kind of an alternating pattern. And so you can do that through eye movements. You can do that through these like little buzzies that are in your hand. But ultimately it's the idea that your brain knows how to heal itself when given a safe environment, which is the same idea as with psychedelics. Okay. And so I hold space. I help people with the regulation while we go back on difficult memories or things that are triggering them, desensitize and help them reprocess it with EMDR. And it can be combined. Sometimes I use some of the resourcing skills that we learn in EMDR to help people prepare for psychedelics. Sometimes we use it to help desensitize difficult things that show up in psychedelics. Sometimes we overlap it with a little bit of ketamine to increase a person's tolerance. It's really fun. Also, hello.
Hey. Hey guys. Everyone, this is Sophia and Christopher. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah.
Good to be here. Thanks for the invite, Jacob.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Great to be back on your show.
Yeah. Oh, it was always a great pleasure. And one thing I'm actually extremely passionate about and very excited is to understand like the differences between your two clinics, you know, hers being from Chicago, yours being from Sacramento, and just how they're a little bit different and alike, as well as getting into a new conversation of psychedelics and how obviously psychedelics are different than ketamine.
Right. So. Yeah. It's definitely a growing space, and I think there's so much area of collaboration with different fields. You know, and you know, Sophia, she's an anesthesiologist, I'm a psychiatrist. You'd think that those two fields would never mix and meet together. And so we started about over 2 years ago, and it's been such a great collaboration. And then also working with other therapists in the community, and we have a therapist that runs our groups. So it's been exciting.
Absolutely. And I know me and Jordan were talking about this earlier, how difficult it is to find psychiatrists, especially in the Chicago area, right?
Mm-hmm. There's definitely a shortage here.
Is there?
It's not just there, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Because I think there wasn't a lot of psychiatrists that were being trained. And then, you know, Americans, we weren't really thinking about mental health the way that we do now. And then all of a sudden, it was just a big inflow of need and the system has not caught up yet, but I think psychiatry residency is becoming more and more popular with the new medical students. There's a big shift now. Before, the psychiatrist programs were not filling all their spots for trainings, but now there's actually wait lists, and so I think we're just a little slow at the gate, but I think that things are going to get better in the next, you know, probably 5 years.
Yeah, I was just reading actually that 33% of young adults between 18 and 25 and pretty close to 30 of like 25 to 49 have a diagnosable mental illness. And like, it's definitely, whether we call that the pandemic or just kind of systems not working for people, it's definitely a crisis, I think.
For sure is. Yeah. What's interesting with the kind of training is when I was in medical school, there was this saying that said there was an acronym ROAD, that there's a road to happiness in medical field. And that stood for radiology, ophthalmology, anesthesiology, and dermatology, that if you went into one of those fields, you'd be happy. And so when I was a medical student, people weren't really thinking about psychiatry. Not that many people were really applying, but now I think there's a lot more interest in it. I think that a lot of that has to do with less stigma. And people are being much more open about the things that they're struggling with, and that's a great thing, because people are then starting to look for help and not really suffering in the darkness anymore.
Yeah, and I think COVID really uncloaked a lot of that. And I think I was reading some statistic now that an overwhelming reason for depression in the United States is isolation, and so I think COVID really fueled that isolation, and now we're just basically seeing the fallout of that.
Feels very coincidental that psychedelics have such a powerful connecting property to them.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Jordan, you're in Chicago?
I am. Yeah. I've been doing ketamine assisted therapy for about 2 years, and then I have a small private practice on the side. We're growing, but doing other forms of psychedelic integration work.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Cool. That's beautiful. And you were also working at Field Trip before?
I was, yeah, just until this past month.
Mm-hmm. Got it. In what capacity?
I was one of their staff therapists, and so
were you a Jedi therapist? Like, didn't it say Jedi therapist? Well, I had
so Jedi is an acronym for Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, and so I helped found our Jedi committee. I offered a couple of different terms, but it's kind of the new DEI to add that justice component into it, because I think that is something we need to keep front and center in psychedelics is access, diversity, inclusion, and then this like justice component, because so many people have been criminalized for these medicines that now we're profiting from, and to be able to offer and keep that front and center in all the work that we do. So yeah, that was part of my role there as well. As by working as a therapist, I helped work on a couple of the protocols. We developed a protocol actually that didn't get run out yet, but for ketamine and partner therapy, which is cool, because usually you think of MDMA for partner therapy. Right. But being able to use a legal psychedelic that's available now, I think holds a lot of potential.
Yeah. And we've done quite a few couple therapies actually.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. We even did one group where it was all couples, like the group had couples in it. Yeah. It's different, but it's interesting. And I think the idea came from just a lot of our patients were reporting improvement in their relationship. Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot of that has to do with them feeling better and interacting better with their significant other. But a lot of people came back to us after the treatment saying things like, oh, you guys really saved my marriage, or, you know, I'm really doing a lot better with my significant other, and I feel like we understand each other better, or maybe we're communicating a lot better. So, yeah, I think ketamine definitely has a role in groups and in couples as well. Mm-hmm. So
I got a question. Like, this is more of like a process group, right? It's not like they're taking the drug prior, like just prior to the group and then going to group.
No, in our clinic, what they do is they set their intention together. Mm-hmm. Then they do, obviously their ketamine journey is separate, because I mean, like, it's just like you're introspecting, right? So you do that together. And then afterwards they integrate together.
Mm.
They do the therapy together.
We had a similar group model. We had actually two different types of groups that we ran at Field Trip. One that was very similar to yours, though they would get a full dose of ketamine, but yeah, it was pretty introspective. We might have something like a sound bath going or some gentle music. But we also did a low dose ketamine to purposely keep people a little bit more in touch. That's actually where we brought the sound bath in. And people felt that even with that low dose, but adding the sound component, there was like this community journey that they went on. And then integrating with some like community art activities and things like that.
Yeah, I think the music can really amplify your experience. And that's what we've noticed with our music. Because initially we were just doing like a silent disco. So as you go into the room, you kind of plugged into whatever track was playing. But now we have developed different sessions of music where there's a beginning, a middle, and end. And I noticed that initially people were like with similar doses, we're getting way more deeper into it. And I think part of that was like the music.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. My favorite analogy I heard is that the music is the magic carpet on which you ride.
I think that's a great one.
Yeah.
You say that the music guides your journey. But yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
I also use the analogy of a river.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
A river, and you have some ebbs and flows. And then around, but the river is going to take you on a journey somewhere.
And you keep moving forward.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really nerd out on the music. I pretty much always every day just listening to different ambient sounding music, and I never thought I'd get into it so much. But it's so rich and structural and textured to it, and quite influential on someone's experience.
Absolutely. Well, I think about the couple of journeys I've been on that didn't have a music component. It can feel like you get stuck sometimes and you get really zooming in on a certain context, but then you add the music in and it does kind of create that fluidity that it makes total sense to add that metaphor of a river of like, you just keep moving forward. You keep moving into these new rooms of consciousness.
Absolutely.
And the interesting part is that even though we don't curate the music for every person, we curate it for every session. But a lot of the times when people, you know, come out of their experience, they come to us and they're like, wow, the music was incredible. It really, like, how did you know that this was the track I wanted to listen to? Or like, this mm-hmm. was like, how did you know? And it's just interesting because they think that the music followed their journey and not the other way around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Music is definitely a very important component of this.
And I think that it brings into kind of context this very participatory nature of the facilitator, whoever that is in the journey of, there is this influence that you have on the journey by providing the right context, the set and setting, right? You help a person develop a good mindset. Mm-hmm. You provide a setting for them. You give them music that provides kind of this like ambience inside their head. And at the same time, like the magic happens between the client and the medicine also too.
Yeah. And I kind of explain it as, you know, you're actually going to be your own therapist in some ways. Yeah. And this mm-hmm. is a good thing because you're not between sessions or after you're done with treatment, we want you to be your guide. We want mm-hmm. you to be able to continue the process and moving forward and not feel like you have to have me or someone else by your side all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We want you to kind of let go and be open and go forward in your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was interested. Do your patients ever like tell you like what their journey actually felt like? Because I know in psychedelics, they tend to have like an out of body experience. And I'm just curious, what do ketamine patients kind of express to you? Like what it was actually like, what it mm-hmm. felt like?
For our experience, some people actually have a very psychedelic experience with ketamine. Even though it's, you know, technically a dissociative mm. anesthetic.
Mm.
So people certainly have a feeling of kind of floating is very common.
Mm.
This feeling of movement is also very common. So mm. sometimes people will describe a feeling that, you know, I was turned around backwards, or I felt contorted in a certain way. And then I moved and I went this other direction. And I felt kind of a falling feeling and then a forward feeling. So that's common. But people can also have visuals that come up. So those can be different things. They could also be a kind of a cross between a memory and a visual. And people mm-hmm. say this feeling of, you know, I saw this, but they might be describing kind of a memory that felt like also a visual. So it's this strange combination of kind of a hallucination with the memory tied also sometimes to the music. So you have sometimes kind of crossings of senses too.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certain things that people can experience it, and it oftentimes can get to a psychedelic range.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I definitely, that was something that we definitely intentionally targeted in at field trip, was trying to get to that psychedelic range. And every once in a while we would give a lower dose and do what's called a psycholytic session, which is mind loosening mm-hmm. rather than psychedelic mind manifesting. But really with that journey, a lot of the same things that you said, I hear a lot of like looking through a hallway of memories or a museum of memories, and like mm-hmm. having the authority to be able to say, I will go into that room or I won't, which isn't for as a trauma therapist, something that people often experience in ordinary states of consciousness. Sometimes they feel more like compelled into memories. I work a lot with people who have ordinary dissociation or traumatic dissociation. And I think one of the big differences between the dissociation that occurs with trauma and dissociation that occurs with psychedelics is like a traumatic dissociation is this idea of like mentally getting away from something. Like I'm running the opposite direction to get away from this traumatic or this triggering event. Whereas dissociation on ketamine or other psychedelics, I feel like it's more like having additional space. Like stepping back to get a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. So that ability to really target PTSD or a complex trauma, it's such a powerful tool. One of the things that's interesting is that there's some imaging studies looking at this where you actually have decreased activation of our fear centers of the brain. So things that we usually avoid because they're so painful, we're actually able to start to see more with kind of a sense of compassion. Because mm-hmm. we're not having that same level of fear or same level of avoidance. So that's another really positive aspect there.
Yeah.
And I think that's really what drives your ability to be able to kind of, well, I call it like metabolize and mm-hmm. deal with those traumas, is actually being able to view and experience them without the emotional component there, so that you can kind of get a different perspective or try to understand a little bit more.
But well, that's kind of, you know, people maybe have heard of the term the default mode network. This idea of kind of our ruts that we get stuck into, these things that we automatically just do and like the ways we automatically think. And psychedelics turn that off temporarily. And so one thing I like to think about is like, imagine you're stuck Midwestern at heart. So in a corn maze, you can imagine a garden maze wherever you're at. But you keep getting stuck in the same places. And sometimes you keep getting stuck with your trauma or you keep getting stuck with your depression. And during a psychedelic journey, those like the walls come down, which is really cool opportunity to be able to see like, oh, I actually need to go this way. But then the work of the integration and all the work that goes in between your sessions is actually going that way, right? Sometimes you get an insight, but it, you have to act with it, which I think is a big difference between psychedelic therapy and other types of pharmaceuticals.
That's such an important part that you bring up, is that integration work. You know, we really think of the medicine as more of a catalyst, and we're constantly reminding people that this, the real work happens between sessions and drawing insights from the session, but that that change we see between sessions. And that's important because people are then laying down those frameworks, new neural pathways, behaviors that are going to help them long term.
Yeah. It's really important to set the expectations up front that this is going to be a very dependent on patient effort. Because I think the people that are failing, I guess those 15%, a big chunk of that is people who just think ketamine is just going to come in and be like the magic pill. And then the next day they're just going to wake up feeling better and they don't actually do any of the work. They don't do the integration. They don't take any of those new things that they've learned outside of our clinic and work on those. Yeah, a lot of the times I try to describe to patients ketamine as being kind of like a window of opportunity where your brain is a little bit more neuroplastic and willing to make changes. And this is basically the time when you need to build your new habits. And if you miss that window of opportunity, really you won't get those long lasting results that you're looking for. And it's also why I think when people take ketamine at home on the daily basis, I think this is just another way for them to replace like a pill. Because they're not really doing therapy. They're not really making progress forward. I mean, are they feeling good? But it's not really something that's long lasting. And it's, you know, what's the goal? Is the goal to get off of medicine or is the goal to just replace one medicine with the other?
So we do actually have some good questions. This is kind of a Q&A, so this is really cool. We have Ashley up and here it is. Could you see the question right there?
Yeah. So what do you think it'll take for ketamine infusions for PTSD and trauma approved by the FDA? That is a good question.
I can speak to that a little bit. You would like to.
You know more than I do. So
I'll fill in if I have anything off. Do you say something?
Oh, okay. Got it. Okay. So really the FDA needs to see some studies. And usually those are clinical trials that prove that ketamine therapy or ketamine infusions are at least equivalent or better than the pills and other forms of therapies that are currently indicated for depression and anxiety and PTSD. The problem, though, is that ketamine is generic. So usually who does the clinical trials? Those are pharmaceutical companies. Pharmaceutical companies have an incentive that if they do the trials, that they're going to patent the medicine and then they're going to make a lot of money. However, ketamine is already generic, so they're not able to patent it. And so there's no incentive from the pharmaceutical companies to create these fund these clinical trials. So one way that we could try to do this is through public funding. And one of the platforms that I am an advisory board at now is called OzMind. And this platform is a national platform and it's a public benefit company. And what they do is basically they have a bunch of clinics in the United States. I think the last time I was talking to them, it was about 350 clinics. And hopefully all these clinics are providing to them their patient data. I know our clinic is, and I know that we've already been part of both of their meta-analyses, which was the ORCA 1 and ORCA 2. But basically, this is how they will pull data from all these clinics and run these large studies, which are, you know, meta-analysis studies to try to prove that ketamine infusions are either superior to current first-line treatments or that they're better. The only, you know, confounding factor there that I see is that not all clinics have a standardized way of delivering the ketamine therapy. So, for example, in our clinic, we have a very robust program. Your infusion is always paired with ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. We also have integration therapy every week. But then again, other clinics are just doing the infusions. Mm-hmm. Or they're not doing the ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. Or maybe they're not doing as much. Or maybe they're just doing groups. So those are like some of the things that I see would prevent us from getting good, solid data. But it's a way, but this platform, the Osmind, I think it's got a really brilliant idea about how to get these ketamine infusions, you know, towards the goal of approval.
Yeah, you covered everything that I was going to think of. The only thing I would say is that there is a form of ketamine that is currently FDA approved, Spravato. Right. Now, kind of touching on what you were saying about like it's not really marketable or it's not really like profitable from a pharmaceutical standpoint, what they did is they took basically half of what we typically are referring to as ketamine. So ketamine has two isomers. We have like the R ketamine and then we have the S ketamine. And I think about this as like two halves of an orange. Both halves are an orange, but together they make an orange. And so they took just the S ketamine part, saying that that was the more effective part. And patented that and put that through and got that FDA approval. So you can, for some insurances, get that covered by insurance. It's a nasal spray. I've personally benefited from it, though I would say in my experience, it has less of the psychedelic component, which in that case, then we're losing out on the insights that you can get from the psychedelic component. Sometimes I can push myself over the edge by adding in things like what we talked about with like the music or like kind of putting myself into a meditative state beforehand. But I think when we start breaking some of these compounds apart, we risk losing out on things we don't yet understand.
Yeah, exactly. So racemic mixture, the way I explain racemic mixture is actually, is a little different. I use my hands, because every vial of ketamine in the United States is a racemic mixture. And basically what that means is it has those two isomers, the R and the S, you know, that's by convention. And sorry, I'm going this way. And so it's basically ketamine and ketamine, except for the difference is that they are mirror images of each other. So like, this is why I like the hand analogy, because both of my hands, they all have a thumb, a forefinger, middle finger, ring finger, and a pinky, but somehow they look different. And why is that? Oh, because my fingers are oriented differently around my palm. And that is basically what a racemic molecule is. It's oriented differently around the central atom being my palm in this situation. So yes, they eliminated one of those chemicals and then they ran the studies and they said, oh, this one is just as effective as this. Therefore, and then they formulated a nasal spray and I'm not really sure how I feel about the nasal spray. I think it has some issues too. But you know, we can get into that if you guys are interested in hearing my opinion on it, but you know, I don't have experience with it, but just from reading, the, you know, kind of like the pharmacokinetics of it.
User, I have never heard of Osmend. Thank you for mentioning this. All
right. Yeah, they're a great platform. They're really responsive. And, the other thing that's nice about the platform is that they have a community section. So one of the things with depression or anxiety is oftentimes we start to isolate and we don't have really a great way to connect with people. So that also is challenging. And let's say that maybe that's the first time that they're going into treatment and they really don't know what to expect. Sure, we can tell them as much as we can, but sometimes they hear it better from someone else that's going through a treatment. And so what's great about Osmind is that they actually have a community for patients, and they also have a community for providers. That allows people to ask questions. And it's a really great resource for them because everyone that's on that platform is receiving some type of treatment. And so they actually got really good advice there.
So we have a doozy of a question, but it's a good one from Neil, a fellow physician, pre-treatment assessment and medical workup requirements.
Is Neil trying to open up a clinic? Very suspicious.
So I'll maybe let you guys talk about the medical side and then I can fill in what I'm looking at in a psychotherapeutic assessment.
Absolutely. Yeah, so and from a medical standpoint, I think it's really important that we're looking at people that are appropriate for the treatment, making sure that they're good candidates, that there's not any contraindications. And so we do a lot of, at least on our end, we do a lot of screening because it really is a commitment for patients. You know, we want people to come to us that are actually going to benefit from this treatment. So we, you know, we make sure that they meet criteria, which for us includes depression, PTSD, anxiety disorders. A lot of these people have gone through multiple different types of treatments before. So, you know, looking at, is this the right type of treatment for you? We also do treat chronic pain as well. And so a lot of the work we do actually is on the preparation in terms of the screening, and then the preparation work in terms of, you know, understanding what this treatment is like, what you might expect, although a lot of things are difficult to predict. You know, things come up during sessions that we really can't predict because we're really tapping into that subconscious mind. So there is a lot of kind of going into it, a lot of screening. And then we also do our medical screening with Dr. Piva, speaking with the patients as well. So that kind of goes over the first part. Anything else you wanted to add there?
No, it's just that, you know, we can't really speak about our protocols. They're kind of proprietary. You know, we've taken a lot of time and thought to develop those. But yeah,
I think it's important that, because these are people that, a lot of patients that are coming to us in vulnerable states, mm-hmm. And really giving them appropriate guidance. Sometimes people aren't good candidates, and we'll let them know that. That they're, you know, you may be better suited for some other treatment. You know, maybe you're not ready at this point for the treatment, but maybe you will be in the future. So certainly,
what would make you clinically say that? Do you have like an example of maybe a patient that might not fit the protocol?
Yeah. So let's say someone has, has maybe just calling about having someone treat their depression, and they haven't had any type of treatment before. Yeah. And they're just calling, they're not sure what ketamine is. And so we'll talk about, you know, there's other, you know, this may be a good treatment for you, but there are also other options to look at. Mm-hmm. You know, we certainly do get patients that are opposed to taking these other treatment options. And so it's important to have that kind of in-depth discussion with them about the risks and benefits of these different options. Mm-hmm. But One thing that I really talk a lot with patients is you have to be prepared for this. That it's not something that we just jump in, because if we're not prepared and we just start doing treatment and you're not kind of in a state where we're ready for this, then there may be more damage than good. Yeah. You know, particularly maybe another example might be someone that's really in a state of complete crisis that maybe they need to be in a higher level of care. Intensive outpatient program or something where we can start to address different things. Maybe there may be other issues going on in terms of substance use that we need to address. Maybe there's medical issues that we need to address first. So we think it's really important to do that screening, to do it from a really cautious and a thorough perspective. And so we really spend a lot of time in that area.
I think screening is so important because we want to be doing this ethically. We want to do no harm. Probably some of the biggest areas of concern I see come up where I might refer to an additional medical provider before signing them on for the protocol and letting them know, like, yeah, I'm good to go with this, would be if there are recent like cardiac issues. If a person recently had a stroke, I often am referring out to get like a cardiologist referral, or like pulmonary issues too. Sometimes those are things that I maybe refer out to. But then from a psychological standpoint, and those things aren't absolute rule outs, but they're ones that I want to get the medical professionals on. In terms of psychological components, it's tricky because psychedelics are an incredibly effective tool for addiction recovery, for eating disorder recovery, and depending on the severity of a person's substance use or suicidality or eating disorder, we might need some stabilization before. Like most types of therapy, sometimes things get a little worse before they get better as we start getting to the bedrock. It's not uncommon for us to be denying the severity of something when we first check in. And then when we get to ketamine, it's like, oh, wow, yeah, things really suck right now. And there's this like learning curve that we go through in the process of healing ourselves. And so I always want to make sure that a person has a solid support network, that if they are suicidal, that they have a good safety plan that they're ready to use. And I'm happy to meet with people for a few weeks to months to get us like that sound foundation to start with. Same thing if a person has just chronic medical issues. I think I'm a chronic pain patient myself. And I think one of the jostling pieces, and I work a lot with people who are chronically ill, is they go on ketamine, they feel great, and then they have to come back to a body that sometimes still has pain in it. Mm-hmm. And we see this for trauma too, like people with ongoing trauma. And I would not recommend ketamine for someone in an active domestic violence situation either, because you come back to a situation that's not a healing environment. And so making sure that this is the right time, not just the right diagnosis for the treatment.
That's huge.
100%.
Yeah. We totally agree.
Yeah.
You probably have this experience too, where we talk to them maybe 4 months ago and then they come back.
Yeah.
Right. And then that's the right time.
Mm-hmm. And it's an intensive treatment. I mean, I think it's kind of on par with IOPs, with the example of like sometimes IOPs help provide a little bit more of that regular check-in. But like for a lot of people, at least in our protocol, it was up to twice a week. And that's a lot of time. And especially when you're adding in an additional therapy session, either after each of those ketamine sessions or after every two sessions, which is the protocol that I'm most trained in. Speaking about the protocol, I think what I can say is that there are kind of three types of appointments that often after you get past the assessment phase. We have preparation, which is like preparing a person from a psychotherapeutic lens, but also sometimes medical professionals provide that as well, of like, what's your intention going into this? What expectations do you have? Making sure that they're realistic expectations and not just, it'll fix me, right? Like, I don't think that that's an intention that works really well. A lot of times the first intention might be something like openness or willingness. And then we get to deeper things like self-forgiveness later on. Then we have the ketamine sessions, or, you know, working with other medicines. Then you might be taking the MDMA, or you might be in a psilocybin trial or something like that. And then you have the integration, which also like works as the preparation for the next session of like, okay, what did that mean? Like, what does that mean for me? What do I do with that information? What do I do with this period of neuroplasticity? How do I prepare for my next journey? And depending on the medicine and your severity of symptoms and the setting, that can go. Ketamine, I think, is best studied for like six sessions with the possibility of boosters later on. MDMA, I think, is usually a series of three sessions. Psilocybin, I haven't necessarily heard of a standard protocol yet, but it can vary.
I think it would be nice for us to look at Australia, because they just started offering this, I believe, or not yet, but June 1st, I think, is their date when they will be allowing physicians who are specifically trained in psilocybin and MDMA to deliver this to their patients. So I think it might be nice for us to look and see how they do with it, and what kind of things, you know, what their protocols are like. Because I think we're basically a little behind them, but it's coming. Oh, yeah. A lot of people believe it's going to be here by next year.
Wow.
And so, I mean, I know we're preparing for it. Yeah. What should I talk about?
I'm interested in this benzo question. He says, how do you deal with opioids, benzos, and I'm a horrible speller. Co-prescribed. Yeah.
And we have a lot of experience with that. I don't know about. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Basically, I mean, if you're a chronic pain patient and you're on opiates, it would be very cruel for me to tell you to quit your opioids before you come in. You know, I don't want to put you in withdrawal, and I don't want to put you in a lot of pain. So I'm okay for you to take opioids if this is something you've been taking. Ketamine, in my opinion, and when I've used it, I don't think it contributes to the sedation part of opioids. Certainly, opioids can raise your threshold for CO2 and breathing. However, ketamine lowers that threshold,
mm-hmm.
which is the unique part about ketamine, and this is why we use ketamine a lot in children in the hospital, because it provides all these different components of anesthesia that are very useful. Ketamine doesn't cause you to stop breathing. It doesn't, you know, build up that CO2. It actually does bronchodilation, which is great because when you're a little kid, your airways are a lot smaller. So smaller room for air there. A little bit of swelling could really cut off your airways. So that's another great component of ketamine, is that bronchodilation. Three, it can cause, you know, that dissociative anesthetic and, you know, pain control. And four, it will keep you very still. So if you're a little child, like, flandering around, you will become a lot more still and cooperative. So in that sense, opioids I'm okay with. Of course, if you do not feel comfortable dealing with opioids and ketamine together, I do not recommend that you take on patients like this. You should always think about, are you able and willing to treat consequences of these things? And if you are not able and willing and feeling comfortable, I would avoid it. So I wouldn't sign on patients with opioids if you do not understand or feel comfortable with those two interactions. Benzos, I'm okay with as well. Again, probably because I've had a lot of experience with delivering both. And I have come to understand, you know, how they interact, and I'm pretty good at, you know, kind of mediating anything like that. The only problem with benzos is they are going to lower the effectiveness of the ketamine. So if somebody is taking benzos, you definitely want to bump up their doses because they're going to need it. Lamictal, same thing.
Lamictal, you have to be careful. I mean, it depends on what we're looking at in terms of the Lamictal, what it's being used for.
What is it primary use for, by the way?
So I'm just curious. You can use it for seizures, and you can also use it for bipolar disorder. And so when we're looking at it in terms of, let's say, for bipolar disorder, at least in our clinic, I'd recommend it for others, is if you're using ketamine, you'd also want to make sure that you're preventing any issues in terms of triggering mania. Now, certainly Lamictal works better for depression, bipolar depression anyways, but I really do recommend that people be on some type of mood stabilizer. You have to look at, though, kind of this person's individual history, right? What is their risk? How long have they been taking it for? Is this something that they can pause for a period of time, or maybe just for one day of treatment? So that kind of gets back into last part of that question, is looping in the primary care docs or psychiatrist. We think that having a collaborative model is really important. It's vital for the patient's care. So really connecting with whoever's prescribing their primary psychiatric medications and working with them and finding, okay, does this person even need to be on this medication? Has been helpful. What are we using it for? Really understanding their psychiatric kind of history and what that interplay may be. So we think that that's a really crucial part of the treatment.
Yeah. Well, and I'll add on to that just as a therapist that doesn't get to make official medication recommendations. But I've worked with a lot of like prescribers in this process of, you know, benzos work on this idea of suppressing our emotions, turning down the volume on specifically anxiety for the most part, is my understanding. And psychedelics is this huge paradigm shift of actually expression. So rather than moving from medications that suppress and make it maybe a little bit more manageable to live our lives, we're actually trying to like express these feelings, like cleaning out a wound so that it can finally heal. And just thinking about that from a therapeutic standpoint of like, you might be getting kind of contradictory forces in your system, and kind of encouraging people that if you want to try coming off of them with your doctor's permission, like, I'm here to help you hold space for some of those big feelings.
Yeah, I'd just like to add on a little bit about the Lamictal.
Yeah.
If you are taking Lamictal for seizures, please don't get your patients to stop their Lamictal. Ketamine will lower your seizure threshold. And if you have not been taking your Lamictal, you might trigger a seizure. In which situation, I highly suggest that you know what you're doing in your clinic if you're doing that, and you have some medicines to help stop that seizure, or, you know, you're close to the hospital, or, you know what to do if somebody's so yeah, that's just one bit. So like, if they're taking the Lamictal for mood stabilizing, sure, maybe they can come off of it or not take it. But if they are actually using it for seizure disorder, epilepsy, certainly please keep them on it and make sure they're taking it like they're supposed to be.
And even for mood disorders, I'd be very, very careful, cautious with this.
Yeah.
again, part of the issue too is that once you have too many changing parts within an intervention, it's hard to know what is helping, what's making things worse. Mm-hmm. So we like to keep as many variables the same, but also knowing that if something's making, you know, if the medication is not helping and they could potentially come off of it, that's a reasonable step to take, but you really have to do that, you know, thoughtfully and with the prescriber that's prescribing this medication's communication.
Jordan, I don't know if you want to take Ashley's question right now or process it, but apparently she goes to a pain clinic, mm-hmm. immune infusions.
Yeah, so I hear this a lot, is that there are a lot of clinics giving their infusions just like any other infusion, any other treatment. You know, if you were looking for additional support, I would recommend going to psychedelic.support. There's an online directory similar to Psychology Today to be able to locate perhaps an integration therapist that might be able to help you make sense of some of your infusions and prepare to not just be benefiting from the pain side of things, but maybe processing some of those other experiences that are coming up. Some integration therapists are willing to travel with you. And so if your clinic is available to letting other professionals come in, that's something that I offer my patients. If they establish with a ketamine provider I'm not already working with, I'll go with them to their appointment. Usually that will be out of pocket because insurance doesn't cover psychedelic assisted therapy. And that's the tricky part. But psychedelic.support is a really great resource.
A lot of the times these clinics that do pain infusions with ketamine, they'll not group in the psychiatric part. And sometimes I think that's a little unfortunate because at least part of our chronic pain is psychiatrically related. Mm-hmm. And so I think working through that component of your pain can really help you lower your pain and maybe try to come to terms with your pain, because pain is, it can have many different components. It can have a physical component, a spiritual component, you know, a mental health component. So really trying to address all the different components of your pain could really help you, you know, with it. The other difference between the infusions for pain and the mental health is that they're very vastly different. The pain infusions are much longer. You're pushing much higher doses there. But yeah, so if you're looking for a clinic that you would like for them to collect your data, try to look for a clinic that has the Osmind platform mm-hmm. associated with them. Because they will, hopefully those clinics are allowing Osmind to use the data that they're collecting mm-hmm. from.
Yeah, with all of our pain patients, we typically also measure other, you know, different response to treatment, whether there's depression or anxiety components. So we're usually using rating scales for depression, anxiety, as well as monitoring pain mm-hmm. response. So that is another factor that we look into.
I'm wondering where Ashley lives. Does she live in a state?
That's actually a good question.
Oh, your infusions are sedated. Mm. Oh, I don't like that. Sorry, Ashley. I don't think that's the right approach.
Is that uncommon?
I've had a lot of patients who come from other clinics who are like, oh, they push propofol at the same time as my ketamine. And I'm like, what's the point of that? Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, putting you under general anesthesia and then giving you ketamine and then saying like, oh, so, yeah, I think those places are missing a big component of pain, which is the psychological part. Yeah. Oh, and you take Valium, so you take a benzo. Okay, yeah, I would strive not to take a Valium. And then she pushes Versed, 14 milligrams of Versed. Are you sure it's that high? I put somebody to sleep on general anesthesia with that much. And propofol. Mm. Oh, wow. Oh, so you're basically under general anesthesia.
So I think this points to the idea that, I mean, wow. I'm of the opinion that these medicines need to be treated different than other forms of medications. And I don't think that that's widely considered all the time. Sometimes people read the studies and they're like, oh, ketamine works and you just need to give it to a person. But I know you guys can speak to the safety of different approaches, but it just seems like you're missing out on something.
That was coming to my head as a missed opportunity for real mm-hmm. healing.
Yeah. Because look, they even put an open airway. So they put a nasal trumpet in, which is what this open airway is. They give her oxygen because she gets so sedated and apneic, uh-huh. apneic meaning she stops breathing because of this propofol infusion and Versed on top. That's a lot of milligrams of Versed. Yeah, so basically the Versed is working against you. Uh-huh. The propofol is putting you completely to sleep. You're not really getting any insight. But, you know, if it's helping you, then keep going. I don't know. I don't agree with this protocol. Anyways.
Also hard to give medical advice over.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the only way they would do it, right?
We're not going to get medical advice over the internet, but it is definitely very different than the way we approach the care is all we can say.
Sure. And I see that on your comment about it being concerns about trauma. And that's, I think, where it's so important. I would highly recommend, if you're not already working with a therapist, to find someone who specializes in trauma and chronic pain, because there are so many overlapping factors there. And a lot of people receive benefits in their chronic pain treatments by just treating it from a psychotherapeutics context as well. So if you're not already working with someone who's informed on those, I highly recommend finding someone. This is a question I get, is like, is ketamine safe for people with trauma? And part of that I've already talked about in terms of the dissociation. I really strongly believe the dissociation on ketamine is different than the dissociation that occurs as due to trauma. But we are working with a window of tolerance, and I think it takes a trauma-specific therapist to be able to do that kind of work, or a trauma-specific psychiatrist, or someone who's trained in trauma, because it's a specialty area. And so on one hand, I'm happy that they're saying like, oh, that's not something we're trained in. We want to make sure that you're safe. On the other hand, I think that there are possibilities of people who would be willing to treat you with a sub-anesthetic dose and manage the trauma from a therapeutic lens, I guess, is the
doctor and nurses can't watch my trauma.
I didn't quite understand that, but I don't understand what that means really. But
they don't want to deal with it, or I don't know, like watching.
Yeah, there's a window of tolerance with trauma. And so if we think about hypoarousal, which we might think about like as like a freeze response, and hyperarousal, which might be like fight or flight. Generally, the consensus is we want to keep people out of those. Now, the thing is, a well-trained trauma therapist will tell you that it's actually completely healthy to be in these ranges, as long as you're eventually moving towards re-regulation. And that's where it takes a special type of training and like grounding skills to be able to help coach a person back into that window of tolerance. Because otherwise, you can risk re-traumatizing and creating new trauma memories.
They couldn't stand to watch the triggers. Okay.
Sure.
They were probably because they didn't know how to deal with it. That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, you must be an anesthesiologist, maybe, not a mental health trained professional.
So it was like it bothered them too much emotionally to watch it, so they don't want to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe that's just what they told Ashley. I mean, we don't know the real reason why, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, when she's sedated.
Mm. Oh, really? You do? With all of that meant on board? I'd be surprised, Ashley.
I think it is worth mentioning that trauma does get stored in the body. And I have heard of people on ketamine sub-anesthetic doses. I've worked with patients who actually dissociated traumatically during the ketamine, and that we had to work to get them back a little bit. It's like memories can show up, especially when you turn kind of that default mode network off.
And what did that look like, Jordan? Like when the moment, like were they shaking or were they like?
Shaking happens. Tearfulness doesn't automatically mean trauma, but that can come up. But a lot of times the body does discharge. If we think about like a dog after it gets startled, what does it do? It shakes off, and that's what the body wants to do. Mm-hmm.
And Jordan, I agree with you, but she's describing a different scenario here. She's describing high doses of propofol, you know, this 2 milligrams per kg infusion. Mm-hmm. This is what I give people to keep them under general anesthesia.
Yeah.
General anesthesia, you're not moving or doing, or you're not even conscious. You are in a medical coma, and this is what they're giving her right now. I'm telling you, 14 milligrams of Versed is a lot of Versed. On top of the propofol, on top of whatever ketamine they're giving her. She's getting a general anesthesia without an airway or without a secured airway, basically. So I mean, I agree with you that, you know, she's maybe dissociation, you know, can happen with ketamine in low doses. We've seen it, we know how to deal with it. Yes, but now when you're adding on all this propofol and Versed, I doubt she's moving at all. I don't know. I mean, I've been doing general anesthesia for 10 years and doses are very suspicious. But you know, I don't know. And of course, I've heard this happening with other people. So this is not the first time I've heard this, propofol being added to ketamine. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of Versed.
You know what I have always wondered too, I'm getting a little off topic, but again, I know before we're kind of talking about like insurance payments and everything, I would just love a world where like everything was taken by insurance. And from what I hear, ketamine is a long ways away because they have to go through so many trials to again get approved by the FDA, even though it's an extremely cheap drug, right?
It's getting more expensive now because demand went way up, mm-hmm. and nobody was anticipating this. And now, you know, all these pharmaceutical companies that are making it are way behind.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a little bit of a scare here with my supplier where they were like, everything's back order.
Yeah.
How are things in Chicago?
Yeah, how are you?
We had a similar thing. We didn't run out, but my understanding is that there was a shortage for a while.
Yeah, so now I stockpiled myself for 6 months ahead because I can't just not, you know, treat my patients.
Yeah. Well, and I actually know a friend of mine is getting a ketamine clinic started, and finding a person to finding a supplier was hard because a lot of these places aren't taking on new clients.
And the other thing is they track how much ketamine you're ordering. So if mm-hmm. you start ordering more than normal or that's how much they allocate to you. So if you all of a sudden want to back, you know, stock up, you're not going to be able to get it. This mm-hmm. same thing happened when the IV fluids were low. Mm-hmm. My supplier was like refusing to send me almost anything. And so I had to source it from somewhere else. I mean, I had to pull out of strings, but it's very similar to this situation now. Mm-hmm. One thing you can do is you can reach out to some sterile compounding pharmacies, which is what I did. And see if anybody is compounding this stuff for the IV version. A lot of people mm-hmm. compound the oral, that's not a problem, but the IV version is a little bit harder to get because you need that sterile compounding area.
Mm-hmm.
So as it comes to the therapy or therapeutic process, we talked about this again before. I forgot, at Propel Therapeutics, do you have coaches? I believe, I don't think you have therapists, right, that work with the clinic?
So we have a therapist that does our online group integration.
Okay.
Cool. And that's once a week. That's for 90 minutes. And that's for all of our patients that are receiving treatment in our clinic. And then we have also another psychiatrist, Dr. Martyr, and myself. I'm a psychiatrist. And we do all the preparation work, intention setting, and integration work for each patient individually. And that starts from the very first. We do the intake, medical assessments, make sure they're good candidates, and then we start the preparation right then. Okay. So each time they come in to see us, they're meeting with either myself or Dr. Martyr, and then we're also doing the group integration in addition to that.
Everywhere I've worked has only hired licensed clinical therapists. So LCSWs in Chicago, licensed clinical social workers, licensed professional counselors, marriage and family therapists. And I think part of that's the liability. It helps with liability insurance a little bit to have licensed professionals. I think the other thing to keep in mind is a lot of the people referred for psychedelic assisted therapies are people who've tried a bunch of other stuff, right? They're the more severe cases a lot of times, not all the time, but a lot of the time. I've definitely seen coaches employed really well. I think what's really cool is in like Colorado and Oregon, they have these kind of paths to being a psychedelic facilitator, a lot of them still require a certain type of training because it is different than other types of psychotherapy. You need to be extra cautious of boundaries and ethics and working with people under a non-ordinary state of consciousness. And that does take some training. But I think that there can be multiple paths to that kind of training.
So in that prereq, like what, do you have to have an undergraduate degree to go through that training or is it something else?
It depends on the training. So, I work as a home group facilitator for a training program and they do require some form of psychotherapy training. I think mostly are there people with masters or mm-hmm. Licenses. My understanding is that there's going to be pathways for people who are more like the spiritual orientation, lay leaders, people who have been doing underground work for a while. There's a lot of wisdom that's not licensed. And I think it's important we pay attention to that while also making sure that there's a certain standard of care that clients are receiving.
When you say underground, it could have like a scary, I don't know, like mm-hmm. feeling to it, but it could also be good though at the same time. I can't put my finger on it. Like,
yeah, well, there's legal risk, but there's also a passion that's there that you're working with a professional that's willing to work on something that is not fully legalized. And so it's this both and.
Professional as in you're talking about someone, let's say hypothetically, did like a year online certification program.
Not every underground therapist has done that, I'll say. Well,
some do, right?
Yeah, some do, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't like, I mean, I'm sure there's pros and cons to like everything. Yeah, just like I was going to say earlier, like there's horrendous therapists that would do a horrendous job with this. And there could be a great coach who took a year online certification course.
Yeah, I think Mindbloom, which is a mail order ketamine provider, which we could get into that topic, but I think they work with coaches. I've definitely referred to coaches for some of the executive functioning stuff, especially I think during that window of neuroplasticity when it's easier to form new habits. I think bringing in coaches for some of the behavioral stuff can be a really great integration. And then we talk about access. On the one hand, coaches sometimes are cheaper than therapists. On the other hand, therapists are often covered by insurance. And so there's that kind of balance as well.
Although I've heard recently that coaches can actually be pretty pricey.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Like the coaching / speaker area. Mm-hmm. Some therapists that actually started going more into coaching saying that they actually
it. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something that be more financially a motivator there too.
The only thing is that they can't use certain terms, you know, they can't say depression. They have to say like low mood or something. There's some like about the way they word things.
It's not insomnia. It's sleep issues.
Yeah, it's not insomnia. It's like sleep issues. I don't know. It's some weird stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, like, would you guys ever consider hiring guys for your clinic at Propel?
Yeah. So, it would be likely really looking at what's the kind of what areas. You know, I think particularly if someone has experience maybe with groups. That they may be able to guide more of a group type of session, maybe it involves more of somatic type of experiencing or breath work. So I think looking at these different areas, people's skill sets, and being able to bring to patients really the best care possible. So I think it's helpful to look outside of what are different people able to offer to patients. And I do think that there's an area there that could be very helpful.
I think when we're looking for people to hire at our clinic, it's a lot of it has to do with how do they fit with the team? Do we think that they will, be a good therapist or a good add-on to what we want our patients to experience in our clinic? We're very, very particular about that. So I would say I'm not so much stuck on titles and alphabet behind your name as I am with what I think you can bring to the clinic, to our patients, and is that going to be something that's going to benefit them? Because at the end of the day, like, this is what we care about. We care that our patients are doing well, that they're happy, that they're getting the best, in our opinion, that they could get from our treatment. So that's really what our goal is, and we really focus on that rather than, are you certified or do you have this license? Because just because you have a license doesn't mean you're good with people or you're good with the therapy part. That's the thing.
You know what I could kind of see down the road though is like therapists getting really upset and actually fighting for scope of practice over the right for ketamine and psychedelic assisted therapy and arguing that coaches are not qualified. I could just see it. I'm not saying it's gonna happen, but I could definitely see it.
Well, there's, I think that's the big argument. It's like, who's able to use these medicines? And that goes beyond professional credentialing, but there's a lot of these medicines, not ketamine, but like that have cultural heritages. And is it appropriate for certain ethnicities for you, like facilitating certain kinds of journeys? And I think that's one of the cool things I've seen in some of the states that have legalized, not just decriminalized, but legalized, is they're creating these paths for different types of pathways for the spiritual use, not just the therapeutic use. For harm reduction facilities. And I'm hoping that those will hold ground so we don't get possessive, because that's like the opposite of what the medicines are trying to teach us. It's all about ego death and like disillusion and connection to one another. And this idea of like, no, only my type of profession can do it. That's like so opposite to the ethos of the area.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, every profession's like that. You know, doctors probably go through that, physical therapists against each other.
Yeah, that's a thing.
the other question that comes up oftentimes in these discussions is, should providers, someone that's guiding or providing or therapists, have experience with medicine itself? with, you know, themselves having that experience. I think that's always interesting there.
That's me personally, I've never tried it. I would be very actually open to trying it. But again, when it comes to an actual definitive answer, I'm just kind of like neutral. I'm like, yeah, they can or cannot. It doesn't really affect me, but yeah.
Well, I think that the ketamine and psychedelics are an experience which we refer to as a non-linear, non-verbal type of experience. And so in my opinion, I think it's very helpful if the person that's giving you therapy has had a few of those journeys themselves, because sometimes when patients get out of their journey, they're like, okay, I had an experience, but I'm not sure how to tell you or describe it. And sometimes when you already have had it, you can, you kind of connect with them a little better and you can understand each other a little bit better. And I think that basically leads to a better therapy session, because if you're able to connect with somebody on that level and understand what they're going through, then you can better guide them and you can better help them kind of unravel their experience and what that means to them. So I actually would like all of our therapists and our psychiatrists to have had at least one ketamine journey before they start guiding other patients. I think that's very important.
I think it's super important as well. And even just because part of probably the most common question I get is this normal? And the answer is nothing's normal. Normal doesn't exist. But it's also, I think, really helpful to be able to tell a person, like, I know a little bit of what that terrain is, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're not out there alone, because so much of mental illness is already so isolating. And, you know, if you're a person who does have like contraindications and you want to get into this field, I just want to emphasize, like, there are other forms of non-ordinary states of consciousness, transcendental meditation, Groff method breathing. One of my colleagues talks about, she gets her psychedelic fix by long distance, like ultra marathon running, and gets into like this totally like surreal headspace while doing that. And I'm like, that's amazing. I will never do that. but there are other ways of, I think, touching a similar enough space. But if possible, yeah, I'm on the same boat. Like, let yourself have that experience too.
Yeah, same here. I like really the analogy of snorkeling or scuba diving is you're going down and exploring different areas, and it's helpful as to be the guide, is have that experience yourself to understand, as you mentioned, the terrain. And you never know what's going to kind of float by you, but at least you know kind of how everything works and that experience, and be able to go into it and come out of it and integrate.
I think that ketamine helps. I think meditation can be very helpful, but the problem with meditation is that it's really hard for people to get into that state of mind.
Yeah.
And I think that ketamine facilitates them getting into that state of mind easier. Yeah. And so actually I recently posted a little study that had looked at, you know, ketamine as a facilitator for meditation. On my LinkedIn, and I think a couple of people were not happy with it, but you know, honestly, I think that the more different angles that we look at ketamine and the space, the better. You know, we're just gonna learn more or learn different things, and you know, you don't have to agree with it or it doesn't have to be your cup of tea, but I certainly think there's something there. And I know that I've read things like this in the past too, where basically ketamine can help you get into that state, same state as you would be if you are if you know how to meditate correctly. It's just a lot of, you can't get there. It's a hard thing to get into.
Professionals have said the same thing about psychedelics too. It gets you into that state much quicker, where when you're doing trauma therapy, one of the main things they teach us in trauma therapy is, how in tune is this patient with their body? Like, how comfortable are they with the traumatic emotions? And the first step would always try to get them to do yoga or learn meditation techniques. And for some clients, that takes a long time. That's why you don't go into talk therapy right away with trauma, because when they talk about it, they get put into that fight, flight, freeze mode while they're talking to the therapist. So they're not even hearing you because they're triggered and in fight mode.
Yeah.
So,
You bring up this idea of like disconnection from the body. And mm-hmm. I think that's so important. And it reminds me of one of my favorite like therapeutic approaches to bring into psychedelic therapy is this thing called internal family systems. Mm. And the short and sweet of that is that we all have lots of parts of self. We have a part of us that's an inner child. We have a part of us that shows up with our family versus our self that shows up mm-hmm. at work. We have parts of us that tell us to do things we probably shouldn't be doing. Parts of us that tell us that we shouldn't be doing those things. And this is incredibly normal. But I think one of those areas that's really important to pay attention to is that difference between, or the conversation, perhaps is a better word, between the mind and the body. And psychedelics often give this space so that multiple people can have the microphone at the same time. You can have actually kind of conversations between parts. And a lot of times that comes out organically without the therapist even prompting a person, like, tell me what your parts think. They're just like, yeah, there's a part of me that was like, oh, I really remember this thing. And there was a part of me that wanted me to remember that it's in the past now.
Yeah, I love that. That's such a great explanation. And we actually have one of the great things kind of working in Sacramento where we are is we have a couple IFS therapists and working kind of alongside with them and kind of them doing the therapy between our sessions and then coming to us, mm-hmm. receive the treatment and doing our integration work with them too. And that part about the different parts comes up and even outside of it. I just think it's such an interesting area.
Well, again, I thank you everyone so much for being a part of this live. It was phenomenal and amazing. So just as we close things up, if any of the audience members want to get a hold of any of you, how would they do so? I guess we could start with Jordan and...
Yeah, so I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. You can find me, Jordan Dabrowski, on LinkedIn. My email is Jordan, J-O-R-D-A-N, like the basketball player, at willowandleafcounseling.com, all one word.
And Propel?
So you can just type in our URL for our website, you know, www.propeltherapeutics.com.
Perfect.
And then, you know, in there I have a phone number and an email. But you could also go on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on there. Mm-hmm. And you can go on the Propel Therapeutics LinkedIn, or you can find me. And my last name is actually Kiva. LinkedIn is the way to go if you want to get a hold of us, or just go into our website.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, again, thank you all so much. It was an amazing episode.
Thank you so much. And it was great to meet you too.
Oh, you too.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for connecting us.
So happy to meet you.
I again want to thank Sophia, Christopher, and Jordan for being awesome and amazing special guests on my show today. It was a lot of fun and I really learned a lot from them. And again, I hope to have them on the show really soon in the near future. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support. And just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behaviorhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behaviorhealthintegration.org. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called Calmigo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to, again, help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.